So I have now determined we need to go on a quest to find the robes of Jesus, because they are the real robes of Anorak, or the robes of Astral Verdict, or the Cloak of the Stars, or the Invisibility Cloak, or any other cloak in any media. It's the robes of Jesus. We need to find them.
Wasn't Jesus wearing them when he ascended?
Do you got a ladder?
No, but I've got a staircase.
Hey. Hey.
You're not human. That's hurtful. Are you that guy with the evil powers? I think everyone has dark urges. It's kind of my thing.
Welcome, adventurers, to the second episode of the He Who Writes on Monsters podcast. I'm Dee Allen.
And I'm Donnie B.
Last week, we covered chapters 1-4, in which Jason gets brought into the new world, discovers some things, fights some things. You were there, you heard it, you read it. Why are you even here if you didn't do any of that? Today, we are going to cover chapters 5-8, and things are going to spice up. We're looking at some magic powers, we're looking at some more fighting, and some more monstering, and some more he-ing. Doing all of those things.
Indeed. Well, let's get right into it. So chapters 1-4 were basically just Jason. You know, we learn a little bit about Jason. We see how he experiences this world. This next set of chapters, going through 5-8, it is going to be a lot more of Jason meeting other people and being introduced to more of the locals of this world. And right off the bat, we kind of saw him a little bit in chapter 4. Coming into chapter 5, we actually get to meet Landomir Vane. Who to Jason is just this wizard looking dude. You know, as we know, he's a local astral magic specialist, worked very closely with Clive, and he attempted to summon a clockwork king from the astral dimension as part of the builder cult. Things kind of got a little messed up and he got Jason instead, which he is not happy about at all. Now, one of the things,
before we get into that, before we launch into all of that, one little character aspect about Jason that I love right off the bat, first paragraph of this chapter. Before Landomir Vane, in fact, who Jason doesn't even know is called Landomir Vane, before any of that, he just sees a guy helpless on the floor. Jason is having the worst time of his life right now. And he sees him on the floor and is like, yo, shit, dude, come here. Puts his hand down. And before Vane knows who he is, accepts the help. Is like, oh, yeah, sure, dude. And then is like, wait, who the hell are you? But right. Like, just Jason being like the good guy at his core. I love that we're already getting into that.
Yeah. I actually had that notated too, because, you know, Jason moves in to help Landomir immediately. You know, a huge character aspect of Jason throughout the entire series. If someone needs help, you help. You know, that's iterated a couple right. of times by other characters.
He's like directly said that, in fact. Yeah. Like,
yeah, that's Humphrey says it. He says it. Farrah says it. That's just kind of who he is. And at first, Landomir's like, hey, it's just some dude come to help. You know, he's accepting Jason's help. He actually notated he was being very cordial about it. You know, it's like,
at first.
Hey, how did you... Yeah, at first, he's like, how did you get here? Thanks for helping me. Reads Jason's aura and is like, you're not really human, are you? Like you don't belong here. Jason's like, yeah, I got summoned. And he's like, that's what happened. That's why all of this failed. And now right, he hits Jason right, immediately, right, right. Like just instant hostility. So a little bit on Landomir's character there as well. That's crazy that we both picked that same thing out. Like that.
Right, right, right.
Little, it was like two lines of the book.
And that actually kind of just brings into something that we'll see a lot later that I just kind of occurred to me too, is you know, Landomir is a member of high society. And so that cordial nature about him, that is pure facade, like, dude is pure cultist, like, you know, builder cultist and blood cultist. But because he's still also, like, known in society, like, this could be anyone in society coming down and helping him out. And so he's like, oh, cordial mask on. And then he's like, wait, who the hell is this?
Exactly.
So it's cool to see these characterizations so well thought out and just like little layers in, you know, just layers on layers of things that you wouldn't necessarily think about unless you're a really good writer who thinks about these little details.
Exactly. And it's definitely not something that I picked up on my first run through or even my second run through, you know, and going through it, knowing these characters in this book and then getting back to it. You definitely see that coming through.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Something about this scene I did notice just from reading the other books, right? I'm in book going through again. I'm on book 8 right now. And there was actually a mention. You and I have talked about this a lot. And the big circle, the magic circle, actually inlaid within the floor of this chamber. The whole time we have been calling it a summoning circle. You know, the book kind of leads us to believe it's a summoning circle because that's what it looks like. Right. And then it was like briefly mentioned in book 8 when Clive was talking about the research they had done into the Vayne Estate and the cultists using that as a headquarters. It was brought up that that circle is actually a magical array used to hide Landomir's intentions from the rest of the family.
Oh, now he had
put a
way.
Summoning circle on top of it and used that to summon the king. The circle inbuilt into the chamber is just a magical array. It's like hiding magic used to hide the room from everybody else.
And that was mentioned in book 7?
Book 8. I think right at the beginning book of 8 or right at the end of 7, one of the two.
No way.
Where all the team gets back
together.
Know. Yeah.
That's a detail I didn't notice. I'm actually just about to finish book 11 on my second run through of the series. And yeah, that's a detail I did not notice going through, especially with arrays becoming such a big deal in the later series.
Yeah.
But getting into just this interaction with Landomir, the first thing that I have written down is something that I think the first time I went through the series, it kind of annoyed me a little bit. Second time through, it was kind of just another one of the running jokes of the series. But this is, I think, the first appearance of it. Landomir, once figuring out, like, looking at Azora, poking around, he's like, "You're not human." And Jason says the line that echoes throughout the whole series, "That's hurtful." And it cracks me up every time because everybody in the series actually ends up saying that at some point. Maybe not everybody, but quite a few members of the team, especially the ones closest to Jason, start to use that.
It does come up. That one line comes up a lot. There are a few things that Jason says in the early books that get picked up as we go along. And I have in my notes for a later chapter about the level of planning that Sherdaloon has put into this whole story. And the amount of world building that we see early on that we don't get resolution until books later. You know,
right,
we'll talk
right.
about that a little bit more detail when it comes up again. But yeah, it's insane. Just these little tiny phrases that Jason has that become the identity of the people he's closest with. Really cool. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, moving on a little bit. We have this interaction with Jason and Landomir. And then Landomir's still out of it. He takes a recovery potion. Doesn't work. So obviously whatever he was doing was so involved that recovery magic is not going to fix it.
Okay, so this is a detail that I didn't notice right off the bat until my third run through as I was studying for this episode. I had you and I even had talked about before about like how lucky is it that he killed a bronze ranker as a normal ranker. Like, he is just normal human. He has nothing going on for him. And yeah. He takes out a bronze ranker in one hit. And what I wrote down was that Vayne is weak from the summoning and that the backlash will take more than a potion to fix.
Yeah.
And I that note stood out and I was like, oh, well, that's how he took out the bronze ranker, because the bronze ranker was ravaged from this failed Clockwork King summon.
Yeah.
And which, like, obviously, you know, as we know way later in the series, Clockwork Kings and summoning large constructs like that is very mana draining. And most of the time we see it later on, it's silver and gold rank people performing these rituals. Yeah. So Landemir is actually kind of going out on a limb here, performing some stuff that's well above his head. Like, yeah, he knows a lot. You know, he's big in the Magic Society and whatnot, but his bronze rank isn't cut out for a summon of this caliber. And then with all the astral weirdness going on and the link between worlds happening and, you know, everything kind of lined up in his failing, like there was just some other nonsense going on and he just happened to tap into some other crap that he didn't mean to. Yeah, it was just way above his head.
And what I had written down is the most likely cause for this, right? So it's a combination of events happening here. Because this summoning was so much above his level, there's a good chance that he had to take some kind of power-enhancing potion or some kind of extra magical potion, similar to like a spirit coin, to give him the boost he needed to actually make this summoning. And what right. I think happened is that creating the magical turbulence within his body, right, is preventing the full effect of the recovery potion. He obviously failed the summoning, so chances are he had some flaw in the summoning he actually tried to do, whether it was a bit of the summoning circle was not quite right, or the magic ambient wasn't quite right, something like that, some minor thing that he might have overlooked.
Right.
So we know that an event of this caliber combined with a surge in the bond between Earth and Palamustis, creating that the dimensional barrier being weakened and more malleable, was how Jason was able to be summoned from that world. So all of those events connecting while he's trying to summon from the astral probably did a little bit more damage to Landemir than he had anticipated.
Right.
And so not only is the backlash worse because he failed, he is also probably suffering some effects of mana toxin from a power enhancing potion, which is how I, based on how I understand the magic works in this world, would assume that's how that happened.
Well, that, or because we do find out again later that Jason comes through because of this weird link between worlds, mm-hmm. and Landemir is using Builder Cultist astral magic to try and do this summon. So it's entirely possible that some just pure, like, transcendent astral, you know, like transcendent damage astral magic is what coursed through Landemir and nearly killed him.
100%. I think that's extremely likely.
Your concept is also very likely as well. You know, it could be one or the other. They don't really ever say for sure whether or not it was a potion or astral magic necessarily that took him out. Obviously something went wrong.
Yeah.
And he tapped into the wrong astral force, tapped into that link and summoned the wrong thing. But
yeah, and we don't know 100% for sure, but it's clear that it created a massive, massive amount of backlash he wasn't prepared to handle.
100%.
And then Jason ends up getting the finishing blow. Which is lucky, because if Landomir had been any higher rank, he would not have had a throat to cut into. If Landomir was silver rank, his body would be mostly magical. He wouldn't have the bodily functions necessary for a stab through the throat to be effective.
Oh, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that either. Because, yeah, silver rank, yeah. They're mostly just a magic bag of meat.
Yeah, Jason's had his whole head removed at silver rank, and it grew back. He was fine.
Well, but there was mitigating astral magic, astral gate circumstances going on there. That's fair.
Also, it's much more difficult to take down a silver ranker.
Facts.
So that's where the luck comes in. Landomir pretty much did himself in, and then Jason's like, "You have a throat still. Boom, done."
Yeah, pretty much.
It's significantly more complicated than that, but basically, yes.
Pretty much. And I mean, it really was just wild luck, as mentioned by the author. It was a literal blind stab in the dark. Like,
yes.
Because as they start struggling, he's holding the lamp. The lamp does, you know, a little disco ball strobe situation as he's spinning around, trying to get away from Landomir, and then eventually flies off. And before the stab, there's actually one little thing that I wanted to mention in there. He actually noticed, so Jason paid attention to the fact that Vayne's condition was a little bit bad, and it's even mentioned in the situation that due to Jason noticing this, he's like, "I'm gonna try to escape, like, forget that." Yeah. And he tries to run past him to get to the door. And he is successful because dude's probably at 10% health right now. Like,
yeah.
Like, nowhere near in condition to, like, quickly react, even though it's bronze rank versus normal rank. However, the door is locked. So Landomir comes in with that knife. And the next little bit that I liked, because Jason is a very pay attention to his surroundings, but also learn from his mistakes, but also learn from his enemies, because it's actually mentioned there that he mimics the lesser monsters by going in for a bite. Like, it's yeah. probably not necessarily something he would have necessarily thought to do by himself. But because it's just what he's been around, all he's been getting bit by these tiny little monsters, he's like, "Fuck it, I'm a lesser monster right now."
Yeah, goes in for the bite. Yeah, that's something that his brain just does. You know, he is very good at learning and learning quick when it comes to the right circumstances. He doesn't learn some lessons, but we'll get into that much later in the series. When he's fighting these lesser monsters, it's always like, there's something attacking me, and then it bites him. Right. And that's happened several times up to now. He's like, there's something attacking me. Bite it.
Yeah, for real.
Go for it. It's like, I don't have a weapon. He's got a weapon. Go for the bite. And that's what he does.
Go for the bite.
And that actually kicks off probably one of the biggest main themes in the entire series, because he gets the bite off, manages to grab the knife, kills Landomir, and this is the first time he has ever killed anybody before, and he goes through a very significant mental breakdown at this point. You know, it is very well described. The writing in this section is insane, because you can feel it. You know, he's in the fetal position. He is in denial, white noise everywhere, you know, absolutely at odds with himself. And throughout all 11 books, and probably soon to be the 12th book, you know, he is struggling hard with the fact that he has not only killed somebody, but continues to kill people, you know, even when it's necessary, even when it's not. You know, most of the time that he's back on Earth, it's about him trying to tell people that he's killed people, and he feels really bad about it, but he doesn't know how to ask for help until he talks to Farah about it and he gets a little bit better. But even into book 11, he's mentioning, you know, the fact that he's killed people, the fact that he still has to kill people. He tells the princess in Rimaros, Like, it's all about, you know, killing people when you need to and letting them live when you can. And that is a big theme for him throughout the entire series. And this is where we see that first, you know, kind of hit of that effect.
Right. And okay, so in the last episode, at the beginning of the episode, we actually mentioned the Friedrich Nietzsche quote that gives this series its name, He Who Fights with Monsters. And this is the first real implement of that second half of the quote, must look to it that he doesn't become a monster himself. So this is the instigating moment where he has to take a life, and he has no choice. It's Landomir or him.
That is his mental struggle through the entire book. And so Jason's whole character arc in this respect is the quote. And it's beautiful how interwoven that is. You know, yeah, it is constantly an unspoken theme, but you're always aware of it.
Yeah, and I mean, it goes through the entire series.
All the way up until book 11 that we've read so far, everything that's been released, it is still a theme, you know?
I mean, well, yeah, he knows the story he's trying to write.
Yes.
And I have a sneaking theory about something, and I'm actually going to be doing some extracurricular reading. And maybe by the next episode, we'll have a bit more to talk about it. But I have a bit of a theory that this series is a bit of an exploration of Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophy done in a fantasy world. And if it is, it's very clever. And it's basically like introduction to moral philosophy via fantasy, and that's pretty cool if that's the case.
Absolutely. I'm gonna have to do some reading on that too. We shall discuss it as the series goes on.
Yeah. I'm already
I'm interested to see how that turns out. Actually,
I have already downloaded Beyond Good and Evil on Audible. It's going to be the next thing I read as soon as I finish book 11, so almost there on that. So maybe by the next episode we'll have a little more to go on in that department. Currently just a theory, but
we will see what we can do with it for sure. Getting back to this book a little bit. Umbral Mountain Snake.
Hold on. You cannot go to Umbral Mountain Snake. We cannot have talked about Nietzsche and moral philosophy and all this other stuff if we don't mention, probably, at least to me, one of the most powerful quotes in this book. I wouldn't say series, but in this book, probably one of the most powerful quotes. And it's just three little words. You did this.
Yes.
You did this.
You did this.
Even he wasn't convinced. Oh, that part. Every time Heath Miller's delivery in the audiobook and just the section like you were talking about the mental break, like, oh, that moment is just chef's kiss. Beautiful moment. I love it. It's intense. It's dramatic. It's all the right stuff. You know what I mean?
It is. Absolutely, dude. It makes me tear up when I go through that. I just read it, but I usually listen to this on Audible.
And yeah.
Like you said, the way that line is delivered, it brings so much emotion. It's three words, and it is it's indescribable.
It's time to escape because as he's having his mental breakdown, a not insignificantly small long black thing is coming his way.
And for those of us playing along at home, that is an umbral mountain snake. Just so we're clear, this is a family show. We get the umbral mountain snake coming out of this little access tube in the ceiling. We find out this is Landomir's familiar, which I think is very humanizing, that Landomir Vane, the blood cultist, the builder cultist, the summoner of evil here, who is now dead, has a cute little bonded familiar. It's just a little snakey snake. And you know he had a relationship with this snake that every other person with a bonded familiar has. And
yes.
Whoa, that was a big yes from you over there. Yeah, you know, it's like it's like that's his familiar. That's his special little guy, you know. And to think about it in those terms kind of puts Landomir in a new light for me. You know, it's that cordial mask that he has, the fact that he has this familiar, not a summoned familiar, a bonded familiar. It's kind of weird to think about.
Okay, and back on the topic of moral philosophy, no one ever really thinks that they're the bad guy. And this is a good example of that, because at least if you look at it through that lens, because he has a bonded familiar. And as we see with characters like Stash or Onslow, Gordon, Colin, you know, a bonded familiar, there's an extra step to that bond, to them as people, to each other. So looking at Landomir in the sense that, like, yeah, he had a bonded familiar, and, you know, he was born and raised in the Red Table cult. However, cults are cults, and they are brainwashing. So if he grows up in brainwashing, you know, I'd say he's 50-50 liable. So you could find a slight bit of remorse for this character. That may be part of what Jason thinks about in this situation, or at least maybe down the road, but they never really mention it again. But it might be an interesting thing to mention later on if he ever goes into a soliloquy about familiars.
I feel in this story it's definitely something for the reader, you know, once we learn about what familiars are and how it works, because like the characters themselves don't get super into it, you know, when it comes to other people's familiars like that. And like you were saying, there's a difference between a summoned familiar and a bonded familiar. You know, if a summoned familiar dies, it just returns to the astral and waits to be summoned again. If the essence user dies, it goes back to the astral. It's like, well, that was fun for a bit. And it can be a familiar again, like with Shade, if it wants to be. With a bonded familiar, it's an actual animal that exists in the world that becomes a familiar. You know, so if it dies, it's not coming back. If their essence user dies, it's still feeling that loss. You know, their person just died. What am I going to do now? You know, there's a lot more emotional with a bonded familiar.
Okay, so then I'm guessing the soul bond that Jason has with Colin and Gordon is different than being a bonded familiar.
Yeah, so there's summoned familiars. They can be resummoned again. With them being soul bonded like they are, that happens because Jason becomes an astral king and they become the voice of the will for their astral king, with the added benefit of being summoned. You know, so it becomes slightly easier for him to resummon them. They get more immunity. Like with Colin, part of him can just exist within Jason's soul realm or his astral kingdom at any time. So if the rest of him dies, Colin's still here. You know, with Gordon, he can just be resummoned within that astral kingdom and come back. I'm not saying it's any less traumatic, you know, with a bond like that. So I'd imagine that when Jason dies, every time after they become soul bonded, it does have a greater effect on them, you know, emotionally speaking, because of that bond. But it wouldn't be the same as, you know, them dying and never returning, because we know Jason comes back. That's kind of his thing. But if he had died permanently, I'd imagine they would be very traumatized.
Right. But because they're summons in the astral, I'm guessing they would have the option to become a familiar again. They just also have soul trauma from Jason.
It's possible. I haven't done this far in my read ahead notes.
Well, so it's either possible way,
die again, or if Jason dies, they cease to exist as part of this astral kingdom.
Right, but we know that that's not going to happen.
No.
Because Jason is going to become Uber God, and we're way ahead of ourselves, because right now, he's just trying to figure out if monster snakes have thumbs.
Yes, yes, he is. We've talked about this a couple of different times, too. I believe the official term we came up with was Umbral Mountain Rayquaza. It's a little snake with thumbs.
I'm right. Oh, it's too funny.
But yeah, that's one of those life or death situations that he finds himself in that's completely ridiculous to us. Like, this is a real possibility that's going to kill him. And we're like,
right.
Snakes with thumbs.
Snakes with thumbs. But you know, and that's a good just a parallel between like a normal earthling brain thinking through a problem in a world that makes no freaking sense at all, right, except in what we would consider to be fantasy, you know? Right. So it's a cool parallel and a silly parallel, because here he is literally running for his life, but the thought in his head is, what if monster snakes do have thumbs?
And in the audiobook, Heath Miller delivers it as a purely serious, concerned line.
He totally, you know, like, does.
It is an absolute possibility, and it is one that we need to take seriously the way he says it. One of the best voice actors ever, I'm telling you.
It is, but that line,
it enters our brain as, you know, yeah. The snake ends up getting the door open, chasing him down this tunnel, back up the well, and the chapter ends in what I can only describe as like the most epic cliffhanger moment for a chapter 5 of a book. Like this cliffhanger should not be as good as it is when we're only 5 chapters in. Like, this is an end of book type thing, an end of arc type thing, but it like actually leaves me wondering about Jason's safety. I'm like, oh, this is going to be the end of the book, knowing full well there's 9-10 more books after this.
Sure, you know? Sure.
I love it.
Now this whole escape scene, there were just a couple points that I really noticed in it. One of the first ones is, as soon as he notices that door is opening, he takes off and he tries to duck down through the tunnel, but he smashes his head and his shoulders into that little opening, and he ignores it. And I like found that to be a very visceral thought, because I know personally, if I hit anywhere right here on my head, it is like probably the most eye twitching, aggravating place to be hit, at least to me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The other part that stood out to me is right after that, Jason is rushing to get up this ladder. And I didn't pick this up until my second time through, but the way the snake is actually traversing the tunnel is like a screw. So in my initial imagining, the snake was just slithering up the ladder right behind him, you know? And that's my initial thought, was like, that's where the weight came from. But I was like, that's kind of doesn't make sense. But if he's helically wrapping himself up, and that's an old weak well, by the time he gets up near the top, if it's weakened due to weathering and whatnot, the weight of the snake actually would, if pressed on all sides, like 100% could bring that crashing down in what you describe as being the best chapter 5 cliffhanger. But
this is a very big snake too. This is not a small snake. This is a bronze rank familiar Umbral Mountain snake.
100%.
And as we know on Earth, you know, snakes don't stop growing until they die, right? They're continuously growing until they die. Being a bronze rank familiar, this thing has got probably a good 100-year lifespan on it, at least. So it's gonna be big, and now it's magical, and a bonded familiar getting stronger with its essence user, it's gonna be a heavy boy.
Here is something I noticed, and we actually notice about Landomir as well, and it's something that we just kind of know, but we don't really think about as essence users. When they go up in rank, along with their bodies changing, they get more massive, they get more dense, right? Their density goes up. And when Jason picks up Landomir right here at the beginning of chapter 5, he notices that even though Landomir has a lanky build, he's really heavy.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that with rank, the same would apply with monsters or familiars, that with higher rank, those higher densities. So again,
that's a very good point. Yeah, actually, I hadn't even thought about that.
Right. And with this snake being bronze rank, you're already 2 ranks above a normal snake. So, okay, let's imagine that this snake is, 50 feet long, right? A regular 50-foot long snake, about the size of your thigh, that thing's probably going to be at least 100 pounds, anywhere between 80 to 120-ish pounds, roughly in right there of just pure muscle. So you add that bronze rank density to the size of that creature, and all of a sudden what would already be 150 pounds might be encroaching close to 1,000 pounds. Who knows? 50 foot of thigh size snake at bronze rank could be encroaching close to 1,000 pounds. Who knows? Maybe 500 pounds. But yeah, that's a lot for some old crappy brick and mortar.
Yeah. And it does. It does bring the whole thing down. That's a heavy snake, dude. I didn't even think about the magical density of the snake.
That's what she said.
Yeah. and it lands directly on top of Jason.
It does.
Jason is underneath this massive snake. We're getting into chapter 6 here, but he is right on top of it. Or it is right on top of him. And just out of pure luck and the sheer will to not die, probably with some plot armor, he's alive.
Right. And the reason he's alive is one massive chunk of the well broke off, which would be absolutely fatal to anything that it fell on, which we clearly see here. And had it fallen anywhere near Jason is splat, no problem, not even thinking about it ever again. However, it falls directly on the snake's head, and as described, one danger took care of the other.
Yeah, I was just looking at that quote, because that's one of my favorite things ever. Let me find it real quick. Here it is. It was said, either the hefty chunk or the snake itself could have killed Jason, but wild luck led to one danger handling the other. And that is basically Jason's luck in a nutshell. That is what we describe, what has been described this entire series. It's always like Jason's getting into something crazy and dangerous. He makes it out, luckily. Like some random 100%. Thing happens and he's alive. He is out of this. He wins the day by luck more than anything else. We do get into the power of friendship being a factor. But it's mostly
and
luck.
Let's not forget the power of will, by the way. That's a big factor later on.
Yes. Yes, it is. We're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yes, we are. Opening up chapter 6, we get a nice little character moment, or at least thought in Jason's head, in that, as a rule, Jason loves waking up. That blissful space between dream and reality, one of his favorite things. Even waking up in the hedge maze, not a problem. But regaining consciousness is not the same as waking up.
No, it's
and
not.
He is regaining consciousness with a large piece of rubble crushing his arm. With that boulder that's on his arm, he notices, oh man, this should hurt. But it doesn't. Oh, it doesn't feel like anything. So, one important thing that I've written down here. No pain, good. No feeling, bad.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of those things that actually has given me real life advice. As it said, you know, Jason realized he didn't feel any pain, which was good. Then he realized he didn't feel anything, which was bad. And that is good medical advice. If you ever think you're injured, when you get injured, if you don't feel the pain, that's all right. You know, you're not hurting. You don't feel anything. You're fucked. You're not doing great yeah. at all. And you need to seek medical attention immediately. So we can all learn from Jason's snake encounter here.
We can. And we can learn another thing, that medicine to heal surface wounds will not heal wounds below the surface.
That's true.
He uses up the rest of his healing unguent in this moment, and it does indeed take care of the outer wounds, but it does not take care of that arm.
Something, my notes for this chapter are pretty loose. It's not a very long chapter, but something I did write down that is going to have a huge effect on the story itself. Mm. After he regains consciousness, finds out that he's killed the snake, everything's fine. He completes the quest objective on Secrets of the Well to not die. Right. Mm. And, you know, that's one of those things where Jason's like, well, if you're only going to complete one quest, that's a winner.
Right.
The implications of this message itself goes all the way into, I believe, book 10, because the fact that he completes this quest implies that he does not run the risk of dying anymore. So he is actually safe. It puts him at ease, which goes back to, or I guess goes forward to Shade's hypothesis that his quest system is some kind of destiny magic. That
right
knows.
I had fate sensors written down here in regards yeah. to that.
Yeah, and this is going to be a thing throughout the entire quest system that we can keep track of, knowing that fate magic is a possibility. But yeah, it's one of those things that's like, well, he didn't die, he's probably not gonna die. I think this is one of the big reasons that he is subconsciously relaxed, decides to go back to try and find a healing potion. He's a lot more at peace with his situation.
Right. Now, before he does head back, he loots the snake. It's not too different than most other lootings. The main difference, though, is that there's no rainbow smoke. And I think we got into this, you and I have gotten into this a little bit, but I believe we came to the conclusion that there's no rainbow smoke because the magic content of the snake is too high, or is it because it's a familiar?
I think it's a combination of both. This is one of the big clues that led me into the fact that it's a bonded familiar. You know, after we get a brief explanation about bonded familiars from Humphrey a little bit later, because it's an actual animal of this world and not a monster. So you kill a monster, it dissolves immediately when you loot it because it's already so close to breaking down into raw magic that it's just gone. Like, that's the most amount of magic it has left. The half of why it's not doing that is because it's an actual animal, and so its body isn't made of magic. It is an actual creature that has magic.
Oh.
And as a familiar, it does have more magical ability than a regular animal. So it's imbued with that concentrated magic that's going to take a lot longer to break down.
Got
like,
you.
If you kill essence user, it's going to take a minute before that body breaks down because it's concentrated, condensed magic that is basically alive.
Got you. And that explains the no monster core in this situation.
Yes. Yeah, because it's not a monster. It's an actual animal. It's not going to provide a monster core.
Got you. I had it written that it was no monster core because it was a familiar, but that makes a lot more sense in that it was just a regular animal that became a bonded familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, because as we know, a bonded familiar, you have to have a familiar power. That power will give you a limited option of available familiars. You go out to an area where those kinds of animals are found, you perform like a calling ritual, and then an animal comes up and becomes your familiar. Much, much more broken down, simplistic version of how it works.
Right.
Prepared the way, I assume the way Landomir did it, he went into the Umbral Mountains, he called for a familiar, and the snake came up, and then they bonded.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. Yeah. I hadn't thought about it that way.
It's got an actual soul, not a monster soul. So no monster core.
Fair enough. And I guess that does also explain why later on when we see other, you know, adventurers or other essence users die at higher ranks, they do turn into rainbow smoke because their bodies are basically just pure magic at that point.
Exactly. And later on in this book, we see Jason's team has gone off in search of a fallen adventurer to return the body. That's only possible because it's an iron rank adventurer and he still has a body to retrieve.
That makes sense. In also the looting, we also get the completion of the Time to Run quest.
Yeah.
And the completion of the Don't Die. And with those, he's awarded a badass scary knife, as well as the dark essence from the dark and scary snake. So he gets a scary knife and a dark essence from the dark and scary snake. I thought that was kind of funny. And it's something I noticed about the essences that he gets and the essences in general, just the essence distribution system. You know, just like you're not going to get fireball from the dark essence, you're not going to get a dark essence from a fire creature or something of the like.
Yeah.
You know, but a umbral mountain snake, a giant black dark snake, is going to give you a dark essence, which I find interesting. Well, at least in this case, it's the quest system that gives them the essence, not the snake itself. But it still falls within, you know, some sense of logic with what he's defeating, with what essences he's granted.
Yeah, and we had posited about whether or not his essences were preordained by some divine intervention, and whether or not if he failed the quest, he would get a different essence from a different quest. I do believe, so I have a theory. Based on just what we've read and going up to these next couple chapters, you are right. You know, the essences he gets match his situation. Aside from the sin essence, we'll have to deep dive into that when we get a couple more chapters in. But so he gets the blood essence in the blood pit. He gets the dark essence from the dark snake. The awakening stones he gets from his quest system seem to me to be specific to his situation, right? Like he gets the awakening stone of the stars, and that's happens in a point where he can't see anything and he's trying to hide, you know, and the awakening stone of the stars is what gives him his cloak of night, which allows him the ability to hide in dark places.
Fair enough. So before we get into looting Landomir, just the last couple notes I had for chapter 6 here. So chapter 6 is called Potent Potable. So the Potent Potable in question is the bronze rank healing potion, which apparently tastes like strawberry schnapps. I swear that there are very small, slight references to certain things that aren't necessarily references. And there are two references right here in the first few chapters of the book. And they are references to Little Nicky, the Adam Sandler movie. Because we've got the bronze ring potion tasting like strawberry schnapps. And then we get him getting hit in the face with a shovel. And both of those things are from Little Nicky. Change my mind.
Change my mind. Well, and we know that potions can be flavored. And so it's absolutely possible that they were flavored specifically for Little Nicky over here.
It could be. It could be. But
very, very, very niche and underplayed reference.
And that's why I think he's doing it. And I see you, Shirtaloon. I think. Maybe.
He's listening to this podcast, going, oh, the secret's out.
Or he's listening to this podcast like, stupid fucking Americans.
That's also very likely.
To be fair, Shirtaloon, we are stupid fucking Americans.
Very true. Yeah, chapter six is basically a cool down and recovery chapter.
And right. Very much, well,
you know, the danger's past. Let's get some healing. Let's cool down a little bit. And loot right. a body.
And actually, this is the first appearance of the cooldown timers. And I think actually the only time we ever get them described to us, a graphic of red, blue, and yellow potion bottles with a little fill up timer on them. And I'm assuming also time because it specified he had 10 minutes from drinking the bronze rank potion before he could drink another potion.
Yeah.
I think it's the only time the actual cooldown timer itself gets described.
I believe so, yes.
But for future reference, if ever, when you think about a cooldown timer, ensure that it's a red, blue, and yellow potion bottles.
Yeah.
In a triangle.
Which is a cool, it's a very cool detail to add.
And that's the one thing I think about this series that is so good but also so hard is there are just a billion little details.
Yeah.
And if you don't re-listen or reread a billion times, you'll never catch everything. And
no.
And so but that's what makes rereading so fun, because I didn't technically get through that until my third read through. When I actually going through the physical book, and I was like, oh, never paid attention to the little cooldown timer thing in the other times I've listened to it. So,
right. And it's like, in my first read through, I'm like, oh, potion thing. Bottle, that makes sense. And then from there on, it was just a little timer in my mind. But yeah, reading through it a couple of times, you actually visualize that little potion bottle filling up.
Right, like it's not like a little timer, but it's always been three little potion bottles. Now, the way that Jason gets the prompts to loot the Builder cultist is kind of funny, because he gets it by being respectful and closing the eyes of Landomir, because it's not in his mind to go, let me go touch this dead body so I can see if I can loot it. Like, he's like, fuck, there's the guy I killed. Closes his eyes. Would you like to loot Builder Cultist?
Yes.
What's a Builder Cultist?
And I, this is where I was going to get into the amount of planning this series has gone through from Shirtaloon. Because we see that mentioned here. Like, it goes, oh, what's a Builder Cultist? And then we never get it mentioned again until book two. Like, halfway through book two is when we find out what a Builder Cultist is, and it becomes a part of the story. And it's little things like this that happen throughout the entire book series. I think the biggest running joke of the entire series is a mountain fortress made in the image of Jason's face building a weather machine, right? He refers to this constantly through every book. It's always been a joke. It's always going to be a joke. It's always, oh, maybe I should build a weather machine. Or, hey, you're evil. Are you building a weather machine? And then book 11, Right? So it starts in book one. Well, I'll mention this again every time it comes up. In book one, it mentioned it becomes a joke. And then in book 11, we see this actually play out. And it's little things like this that happen throughout the entire series. We'll get a passing reference at a joke. And then 4, 5, 6 books later, it becomes an actual joke.
Yeah. And I actually just passed that part this week while I was listening through book 11. And oh my God, the part when he's like, Clive is trying to explain the weather machine in any way other than weather machine. He's like, oh, it's an atmospheric, blah, blah, blah. It affects the array, blah, 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 blah. And then Jason just in the back, weather machine!
Yes.
So freaking good. And it's like, and you can almost feel the joke payoff in that line from Shirtaloon. Like that, as much as Jason is saying that, that is Shirtaloon also going, weather machine!
Because you know he's been planning this joke for 5 years.
100%.
He finally writes it in. He finally gets a chance to build that joke into the story.
Right. Like, he is like, yes! I am 100% going to do that. It's going to be hilarious.
Yeah.
And we'll get to it when we get to it. But the fact in that moment, he's playing around and everyone's like, dude, you can't be serious right now. And he's like, I started hours ago. Don't worry about me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just trying to be me. Like, can you let me be me?
Right. And that's that's a little bit of the attitude Shirtaloon has throughout this book. You know, it's like, yes, I'm writing the book. I'm having a little fun while I do it.
100%.
I'm just being me, doing my thing, and you're getting a book.
Speaking of the little fun, as he's going to loot him, his first thought is, oh, it's not going to skin him, is it? And it reflects back to the little night scale leather that he got from the snake. Mm-hmm. And that put the thought in my mind of a neat little package of human leather.
Not a visual I needed today. Thank you.
Hey, but you got it.
I got it.
Now, with Landomir, he gets a buttload of coins. In fact, 4 gold, 16 silver, 138 bronze, 437 iron, and 228 lesser spirit coins. Gets a lot of coins. He gets the robes of Anorak. That's what they're called, right?
It's a little more complicated than that, but basically.
Okay. I actually have a theory. Now, this is a personal, real theory, and something has come to my mind, and I think that there is a real-life quest that we need to find.
Okay,
so in every media that I can think of, robes are an important thing, right? You've got the robes of Astral Verdict right here. Super powerful, cool robes. It's almost a relic. It's not really a relic. We'll find out about what relics are later. But then, all right, Star Wars, you got Obi-Wan's robes, right? You've got, in Ready Player One, you got the robes of Anorak, some robes of power. So I've determined, in our actual universe, what is the magic? Like, what do we view as magic? Well, we view miracles, the miracles of Jesus. So I have now determined we need to go on a quest to find the robes of Jesus, because they are the real robes of Anorak, or the robes of Astral Verdict, or the Cloak of the Stars, or the Invisibility Cloak, or any other cloak in any media. It's the robes of Jesus. We need to find them.
Wasn't Jesus wearing them when he ascended?
Do you got a ladder?
No, but I've got a staircase.
Hey.
Oh. Honestly, if they existed in this capacity, the Vatican probably has them. And we're not going to be able to break into the Vatican.
Call Nicolas Cage.
Maybe. We are getting very off track here.
We're way off track. All right. So now one thing I noted here, once he gets the robes, obviously these are clothes he could decide to wear. However, they are soaked in blood. And this was an aspect I found interesting. So certain video games, like Legend of Zelda, for example, their inventories are like a stasis. So, you know, if you have a torch, for example, you can put it in your inventory. I think, don't quote me on this, but you can put it in your inventory. It'll stay lit, bring it out, stays lit. I'm sure there's a game where it's like that. Jason's inventory is like that, which implies it is unlike certain other video games inventory that might refresh an item when it goes into your inventory. So there are certain games where you'll have an item that's acting up, you put it in your inventory, come back out, it's just back to being a normal version of it. This is not the case. So his inventory does not magically refresh his items. So he's going to put those in his inventory. When he pulls them back out, they're still going to be nasty and blood soaked. And I thought that was gross and interesting.
I don't want to think about it. And we know later on that he goes to the trade hall and he sells off these robes, which means at some point he had to take them out of the inventory, clean them up, you know, actually deal with this little bit, and then prepare them for sell. And
So anyway, as we're still going through the Landemir loot, looks at some of the healing ointment that he got from the office of Landemir, and he finds one that has Greenstone Academy written on it, or Greenstone Magic Society, or Greenstone Academy, whichever.
Greenstone Alchemist Association or Alchemist Guild, one of the two.
That's Alchemy Society, whichever, yeah.
Greenstone Alchemy, that's what it says.
Point being, he can read it, however, when he looks at each symbol individually, they don't make any sense to him. And I thought it was kind of interesting because it's kind of like to know something without knowing it. It's kind of on the same realm as like the skill book knowledge, mm-hmm. But it's just an ability of his, and he's just like able to read this shit without knowing how he's able to read it. So it's like it's completely innate to him. But also, what?
Yeah. Basically, it's like somebody who can understand another language but can't speak it, you know?
Interesting.
Because I've met people who can speak Spanish, right? They understand English, but they can't speak English. They can only speak in Spanish. But they understand when they hear English what those words mean.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That has blown my mind for years now. Just that.
I mean, that makes sense because, like, I know a lot of Spanish words, but I never really learned to do the grammar side of things. So it is kind of like that with me, where, like, I can pick up on what is being talked about, but not necessarily specifics about it.
Yeah, it's like you understand the context of the conversation, but not the words that are being said. And this whole chapter is really just a loot recap kind of chapter. So we learn a lot about what he has, what he's accrued, and what it all does. And then us being the way that we are getting a lot out of this.
I know, because really all I got, I mean, yes, like really they're just going over loot, but I got a lot of little details. Like one little interesting thought that I had was, okay, so the keys that Landemir has, they specifically say, and this is actually how Jason himself learns the name Landemir, is he gets Landomir Vane's keyring.
Yeah.
Here's a question I had.
Okay.
So because these keys specifically say Landomir Vane, are these keys soul bonded to Landomir?
I would say no. And I would say that because the way the item is tagged and description would be similar to how people identify different items that may have copies, right? So it's like, these are his keys because they took them from Landomir. I'm assuming every person at this at his station in the family, right? You know, Cressida, Alicia, they all have their own set of keys. They're all the same keys, but everybody has their own set. So, like, this is his set of keys, you know?
Okay, but in the inventory, in Jason's inventory, it specifies Landomir Vane's keyring, right? Like, is that just an inventory quirk, like in Skyrim, where it's like, you know, like, this is the Winterhold Keep key. This is the, you know, like, blah, 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 blah key specifically. Is it like that as an inventory quirk? Like, it just, you know, the fate sensors know whose keys they are?
Yeah, I think so. It just describes it as his key ring because he got it from Landomir. You know, if it was soul bonded, Jason wouldn't be able to use the keys. Because that's how soul bonded items work. So I think it's just identifying where those keys came from in his inventory. It's like tyrannical pheasant meat. It's meat that came from a tyrannical pheasant, as opposed to just being meat.
Hear me out.
Hearing you out.
So if I had a dimensional storage space. Or actually, rather, if we had just dimensional storage spaces and you put my car into your storage space,
okay,
would it be labeled D. Allen's car, or would it be labeled Vistar Credit Union's car? Because I may own it in the sense that I drive it every day, but I don't own it.
I feel as though it would identify it as D. Allen's car, or being my storage space, it would probably specifically notate it as D. Allen's Toyota. Because you are the contextual owner of the car. Right. So, like, Landomir doesn't own these keys. It's the keys to stuff that his family owns. Everybody's got some, you know, but that was his set of keys to personally use. It's not about technical ownership. I think it's about possession.
Subjective ownership.
Yeah. Yeah. So you possess the car.
Gotcha.
So it is your car. Regardless of who technically owns it, this would be something that Palamustis doesn't really have to deal with. Presumably not having things like implied ownership and credit sharing.
They 100% have credit sharing and loans. What are you talking about?
Yes, but it's it wouldn't be like, hey, I'll give you money for a Heidel, you pay me back. And if you don't, it's my Heidel. Like, you don't own that Heidel. While you're paying somebody else back, I'm assuming it's like, hey, I'm going to come beat you up and get your money back, get my money back one way or the other. Not like, legally, I own this thing until you pay me for it.
All right. Right? In the comments, I want y'all to argue about, or at least tell us whether you think there are Heidel contracts out there. I need to know. This is the information I need.
I agree. Let's discuss Palamustis loans and credit.
Yeah, let's bang on Sherdaloon's door at 3 a.m. and be like, sir, what is banking in Palamustis like? What are the interest rates?
I swear, if book 13 comes out, And he's got an entire credit union description of this world. I'm going to lose my mind.
Fucking fantastic.
Yes.
That would be fantastic.
We are going to revisit this conversation.
100%. Well, moving on to the rest of the items. He gets a dagger. I don't know if it's... Oh, no, the night fang dagger. So that is critical foreshadowing to Jason's future life as an affliction skirmisher, because it is actually the perfect weapon for an affliction skirmisher, because it is a melee weapon that inflicts. So he be skirmishing, he be inflicting.
Yeah, it's gonna all count as afflictions that he can multiply on, and
I like it,
and use later on. Punition is punish, all gonna be very useful with this night scale. This basically becomes his plus one dagger for a while.
It does, because his plus one dagger. Now, here is something that I picked up on through a set of skills of my own called basic math.
Glad one of us can do that.
While actually reading through this, I paid attention to the fact that, granted, this is stuff I know, but like actually doing the basic math made it like make more like effective sense in my head, that at the end of the day, a full-fledged essence user has 20 abilities.
Yes. Not including racial abilities.
Not including racial abilities. And I thought that was interesting. I didn't actually ever pay attention to the fact that it's 20 abilities. And the fact that your brain can pay attention to what all of those things do in accordance with each other is insane. Because I can't do that. I didn't even know there were 20 until my third read through.
To be fair, with an ability set like Jason's, where every single ability is interacting with itself in different ways, I did have to write down what all of the abilities did and how they interact with each other. Because for the longest time, you know, I could not understand. Like, I got the basic idea that his afflictions multiplied and just kept multiplying at a certain point, but I couldn't figure out how that was happening, you know,
right,
and where this damage was coming from. So I had to write it all down and be like, hey, this does this, which does this, which does this. It's basically a stack of instants every time he uses a spell.
Gotcha.
And so that took a lot of brain power to actually understand fully. But yeah, it's something that I love doing. Playing games like Baldur's Gate, you know, where everything you do is mapped out in D&D, where you figure out how to use your abilities in what order and your spells. It has helped me a lot with, you know, keeping track of magic systems like this. So actually playing games like Divinity 2 is a really big reason that I got into magic systems, because it's very similar to how, you know, this magic system and how D&D magic systems all work, because you have abilities and with cooldowns that you have to use in specific orders at specific times to get the maximum effect. You're basically min-maxing your abilities every single time you get into combat. And so keeping track of what everything does and how it interacts with your other spells is just something that I got really into. So it made it a little bit easier for a magic system like this.
Interesting. Yeah, see, I mean, even in the years that I played Pokemon, like, I mean, there was only a brief period of time where I had a really big support system of other players who understood the system better than I did, where I was able to build cohesive teams that had cool interactions, but on my own, I just can't function like that. I don't think like that. It's crazy.
It's basically like Magic the Gathering. You know, you can have a red deck that's just simple and damage, or you can have a deck that triggers an effect every single time you do anything at all.
Right.
And you have to pay attention to those effects. Freaking Kyle built a deck like that one time where every single time he would cast a spell, it would take 20 minutes for us to go through all of the different effects that triggered and when they triggered and how they triggered and what triggered off of that. And that's basically what Jason is doing every single time he fights.
Now, on the topic of the magic system, bringing us into Chapter 8, it is actually time for Jason to start delving into that magic system. And right here at the beginning of Chapter 8, he is dealing with the thought of, is he being tempted to take the dark evil powers?
Yes.
And that is an interesting thing just right off the bat, that I think you told me about this. I hadn't even thought about this even myself this way, but he's not getting the power of evil darkness. He's getting the power of the absence of light darkness.
Yes.
It's not evil dark. It's dark. Dark darkness, nighttime darkness. And so, you know, the whole joke about it, are you the guy with the evil powers that we get later on? It's funny because, you know, even we as the reader are cued to think that this guy has got evil powers, the dark essence.
Yeah.
And you don't think that it's, oh no, just darkness. The absence of light, it's not evil, it's just actual darkness without right. And that's the thing. Evil connotations.
Yeah, and that's something to look back with a read through, you know, because not knowing how essences work and how magic works seems very dark and brooding, especially when you get to the sin and the doom essences. You know, it seems right. very evil. And then you realize later on when they describe, like, essences are just manifested purified blocks of magic with certain affinities, right? So you get the water essence because there's a lot of magical water, and so it manifests right. into an essence with the attribute of just water. You know, you right. get grass, you get fire, and the dark essence is just, that's why it's called an essence, right? Because it's essentially what darkness is. You know, like the word darkness means Ooh. Absence of light. Essentially, it's darkness. You know, it's with the blood essence
of darkness. I like yeah. that.
Yeah, the blood I essence. Like that. It's like it's a cube that manifested because there was blood. Right. It's so the fact that there's blood present means it's a blood essence. It is essentially blood.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, in here, as he decides to take this essence, he just kind of is like, yeah, fuck it, YOLO, we're going for it. And this is really the only section of the series, really, where we're ever cued in that taking essences might be painful. But I think that's actually due to the fact that he's doing it wrong. He's not doing the proper ritual to merge it with his soul. He's just like shoving it right into his soul. And his soul is like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because as he takes the dark essence, it's searing pain that knocks him out. Like he passes the fuck out. He throws up and passes out.
Yeah,
from the pain of this, from the dark essence.
Yeah, it's basically like taking a shot without a chaser. You know, it's gonna hurt a little bit more because he's doing it in the most direct way possible. Something I did want to get into here because I can't help thinking about it every single time. So we get the first ever help screen. Which immediately is like, oh, help is an option?
Right.
And it always shows up at like the most random kind of funny times for us. And every single time the help screen shows up, the very first thing I would do if I had this ability is concentrate as hard as I can on pulling up an encyclopedia page. Like, can you give me just a list of every help message you can give me so that I can go through, kind of like in No Man's Sky, where you have the encyclopedia, tells you all the different things, and be like, help is an option. Like, give me every help message. Every help message you were programmed to give me, give me. And see if I can view a whole thing, learn as much as I can. I would be sitting in that chamber for hours on end, just reading every single thing that I can, getting as much information as I can. And it kills me that this never comes up.
Now, okay, this is funny because it kind of plays off of something I have written down here. So I wrote down that the help function is snarky, which he mentions himself. Yeah. But I wrote down that it's kind of like Guppy from the Bobiverse series.
Yeah, absolutely. Because
Guppy is an interface system who kind of gains a bit of sentience and gains a bit of snark as that series goes on. And the fact that you're like, oh, I would ask it for an encyclopedia. And if it's at all snarky in the same way as Guppy would be, when Bob in the Bobiverse does essentially quite the same thing, Guppy is just like, yeah, sure, here, and just hands him this giant block of text and is like, yep, here you go. And yeah. It's like this undigestible block of text, basically.
And that is absolutely what would happen here, but I would try nonetheless.
Yeah, and it's funny because it feels like almost like it would be a similar situation with these kinds of, you know, intelligent interfaces. Obviously, very different story styles, very different types of interfaces. One's an AI. This one is fate sensors, or at least that's what I figure it is that I've written down here.
To be for sure.
Now, what he obtains from the Dark Essence, at least the first ability of five that he gets from the Dark Essence, is Dark Vision. And as with any D&D character who is not human, of course he has Dark Vision.
Of course.
But in this scenario, and really for the rest of the series, it is a useful tool for him. And as even D&D players will meme about it, but it's still useful in D&D too. But it's always funny where it's like, oh, you guys enter a dark hallway. Anyone have dark vision? No one here is human. Everyone has dark vision. Like, yeah. Never mind.
Every time. And this is playing off of what I had with the Awakening Stone of the Stars, which he also absorbs and gains the Cloak of Night. You know, going towards the theory that, like, your personality and who you are shapes the essences and abilities that you get. You know, he gets two powers here, Dark Vision and Sparkly Cloak. And in his current situation, up until this point, the only two things that he has been doing is running away and hiding and not being able to see in the dark. And so it's my belief anyway, my own headcanon, that his needs have shaped the abilities that he has unwoken, in the sense that now he can see in the dark without blinding himself with the light, which is something he needed to do. And now he can hide in the dark, which is something he's been doing the entire time.
Right. And it's even mentioned that when he goes to use the cloak for the first time, that he's like, oh, it felt like it was always meant to be there. Like, it was just always there. It's an extension, like a limb. And kind of playing on your thing about it being what he needs, but also an aspect of himself. Like, it really was, you know, any of these abilities, you know, have the potential to be awakened. Anybody could take these same essences and under these similar circumstances might end up with a very similar power set to Jason. But the experiences that you have mixed with the essences you take awaken different elements of you. And I think that's kind of cool because, you know, on the moral philosophy / human growth side of things that I think he, Sherdaloon, might be getting at with this series a little bit, We as people have unlimited potential, but it's our experiences that shape us. And, you know, you could consider the opportunities that we are handed to be the essences that we are given, you know,
100%.
Me being a musician, you know, maybe I took the, you know, I took the vocalist essence or whatever, you know.
Right, right.
Or whatever it might be, you know. So I think that's kind of a cool point in that, you know, we as people have unlimited, untapped potential, and we could be anything we want to be, but our circumstances also dictate who we are, and that's very relevant in this magic system, in this series, and in real life. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's all woven together, and it's beautiful. One of the reasons I love this series, you know, is it's personable. You know, Shirdaloon knows how to write to his audience and to who people are more than what people want to read, you know, which he's also very good at, let's be real. And it's absolutely gorgeous. And essences, I feel like, are just a physical way of manifesting that philosophy and that theory into our minds.
Right. But because this is a silly fantasy series, as deep as things go, there's always some layer of joke or fun that's on the surface, be it in Jason's character or in just the scenario that we are presented to as the reader, because here you and I are talking about these deep concepts. All the while, the first thing he does when he gets this cloak is realize he can basically bounce around like he's on the moon.
Yep.
And absolutely. So he even himself is having these deep thoughts while he's bouncing around like an idiot. And then he remembers, oh, right, there's the corpse of the guy I killed.
Yeah.
Bit in bad taste, huh? Probably should stop jumping around.
And let's be real. We all would do that. That would be all of us. 100%. Like, wait, what do you mean I can float? Let's do that real quick.
Now, with the description of the cloak, maybe a bit of foreshadowing or just maybe another bit of Shirdaloon paying attention to tiny little details. But I noticed the cloak in its innate initial form is kind of a gestalt entity. Not a soul body thing, but it can be both physical and you can grab it, you can touch it, you can flick it, whatever, or your hand can pass right through it. So it can be material or immaterial, and it's a bit of a gestalt in itself. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a cool little tiny detail towards what Jason becomes in being a gestalt entity himself. His first ever item, cool magic power item, is a gestalt in itself by its original nature.
Yeah. Yeah, and I definitely think that's a little bit of foreshadowing happen. I believe it's described as a dimensional effect, which is what a gestalt entity basically is, you know.
Right.
Just without the soul part. So it's very cool. It is very Jason, and throughout the whole series, that's going to be like his mark, his trademark is the cloak.
Right. Now, with Jason's not perfect understanding of the magic system, he decides to summon and de-summon the cloak a bunch of times in a row, three times in a row. Completely draining his mana in doing so. And the help function then pops up and is like, hey, dude, if you want better mana recovery, maybe link an essence to your recovery attribute. Which
is the most helpful form.
Right. Now, and we do find out, and we'll get into it a little bit in the next episode or two a little bit, but the blood essence that he gets is what ends up becoming linked to his recovery attribute, and his powers in that essence make a lot of sense with recovery. So it's kind of cool that not only do these things awaken. Now, Dark is his power essence? Is it power? What is dark?
Dark is linked to his speed.
Oh, dark is linked to speed, which makes sense. So the cloak can affect his speed, both slow and fast, as it grows. So one of the first abilities in it is slow fall, so a speed affecting ability. And later on, he can get the shadow jump and all of this, which is a very fast motion based ability linked to speed. So I think that's cool. Not only is it linked to him, his circumstance and all that, but also the attribute that it's linked to will have a big effect.
Yes. And I actually had this in the notes to talk about a little bit later down the line. But his dark essence being his speed attribute makes sense. And the majority of the powers that he gets from it turns this whole attribute into basically his utility attribute. He gets the Midnight Eyes, which is a vision power, the Cloak of Night, which is basically just a tool. He gets Path of Shadows, which is a movement ability for his speed. Shadow of the Hegemon, or Shadow of the Reaper, as it will be soon. And then much later of the Hegemon. I'm way too ahead in my notes. I'm sorry. Shadow of the Reaper, which is his shade. Shade becomes his familiar there. It is a familiar power, but the majority of what Shade does is utility. You know, scouting and tracking and providing jump locations for his Path of Shadows. All utility-based. And then the final one he'll get is the Hand of the Reaper, which is just another arm. So basically everything he has in his dark essence, its speed attribute, is all utility-based. And I feel like that's a big thing. I'm going to try and keep track of that as we go on. Which like essence is linked to which users. When we get into Sophie and Belinda, we'll talk about it a lot more.
Here's what I find interesting. So now, he and his power set is not inherently fast, right? But why is it that his speed attribute is the first one awakened and not his power or his recovery or something else? Why speed in the first place?
So I have two theories about this. The first one being a dark essence. You have the power of darkness itself manifest, not a very physical, tangible thing, right? Not a very healing-oriented thing, right? It is basically a utility-based essence, right? If you just look at darkness itself, the essence of darkness is pretty utility. And the fact that that is what's bonded to his speed attribute, I think I've listened far enough, I've taken these notes well enough, I don't think that each essence is bonded to a specific order of attributes. I could be wrong, right? I'll go over it again.
Because like, think about it. So imagine you have a character. So let's say you have an essence user who is a brawler, right? Mm-hmm. And he takes a dark essence and it goes to his power essence. And then all of a sudden, you know, like a shadow arm ability similar to Jason's might manifest as just giant shadow fists that come out and it's a physical attack, right? See what I mean? Or in the healing side of things. So let's say it was linked to recovery, right? So then, you know, in the middle of a battle, if you take cover in the shadows, you gain healing or something. Like, right. I feel like you could make an argument for any essence to go into any attribute. So the question is, is speed just always the first attribute?
Right. And I'm going to look at that again later. Because that an answer that, for you by the next episode.
That could be the case. Because they do make a mention of paying attention to what essences you use in which combination, in which order, when prepping for your confluence and whatnot.
Right. And I think that is more described on the powers that you awaken from subsequent essences, right? So if you absorb you know, like the wind essence, and you get a mobility based power, and then you absorb a swiftness essence, it's going to be another mobility based power, you know, to round out the first one. Whereas if you use the swift essence first, you're gonna get a mobility power, and then the wind essence has a secondary effect that gives you maybe an attack power instead. You know, I don't know 100%. I'm gonna take notes. I'll have these answers for you.
We'll get there when we get there.
Yes. My other theory on this is Shirtaloon knew where he was going with this.
Right.
What powers he wanted Jason to have where, and Jason is running away from everything right now. He is hiding from everything, and his speed is going to be doing him the most amount of good right now.
That makes sense. Well, yeah, and I mean, I guess escape and time to run being the quests, that might make sense.
Yeah, a little hint drops there. But we will discuss it further as we go on, as we learn about other essence users, what essences they have. And like I said, Sophie and Belinda will be a very big part of this conversation when we get to book two. Because we'll be able to observe every essence that they awaken in which order and what powers that grants them in which order, like we do Jason. So we'll have several ones to kind of see to compare.
Now, to wrap up the chapter and the episode, want to go over a quick little bit that just happens right here at the end. So he's playing around, taking in all the magic. He sees the ritual magic book that he can absorb. It was the only one he was able to absorb out of all of them, which I did want to mention, I think. So we do figure out that there is Astral Magic 1, Astral Magic 2, Ritual Magic 1, Ritual Magic 2 there, correct? But it says, yes, he can only use the Ritual Magic 1. And I thought about it. I was like, well, why can't he use Astral Magic 1? And I realized it's probably because Astral Magic 1 is an Iron Rank book and he is still Normal Rank.
No, I actually had that. No. Astral Magic 1 is a Bronze Rank book. Ritual Magic 2 is a Bronze Rank book. Ritual Magic 1 is an Iron Rank book. The reason I believe he can use Iron Rank books, like skill books and Iron Rank tools, is because Iron Rank is close enough in magical power to Normal Rank. Because we know the power disparity grows exponentially. You know, it's like if you were like as a level 1 mage, that'd be like Normal Rank. If you make it to level 2, you're Iron Rank. You make it to level 5, you're Silver Rank. If you get to level 10, you're Bronze Rank, then 10 is Silver Rank. And then it's like level 20 would be your Gold Rank, and then 50 would be your Diamond Rank. So the amount of power disparity is growing so exponentially that Iron Rank is just too close to normal. Why Astral Magic 2 or Astral Magic 1 is a Bronze Rank item and Ritual Magic 1 is an Iron Rank item, I have no idea.
That actually would make sense because Astral Magic is quite a bit more advanced than Ritual Magic. You know, Ritual Magic you can likely use to boil water. You can use to do simple little things. I mean, we see Ritual Magic throughout as just being simple everyday magic, right?
I think that would be more array magic than anything, but in terms of essence users,
array magic would be natural magic, but like ritual magic would be like, you know, you would put like a little sigil on a broom to make it sweep by itself. You'd put something like that. You would do small little ritual circles to make whatever you wanted happen. It's everyday simple magic that even simple craftsmen who aren't even Iron Rank would use.
I believe we're going to have to do some research into this. If somebody knows, write it in the comments. But I believe the difference is ritual magic is like just a thing you do real quick. Array magic is a permanent ritual structure, like with plumbing and running water and heating and stuff. So I do believe that the array magic is just a permanent form of ritual magic and can be employed on a grand scale.
Okay, I'm well, you just said it yourself then. Sure. Because if Array is permanent, then Ritual Magic, by default, would be easier because it's not permanent.
I do believe you're correct, though, in the level of advancement. So,
yeah,
as an Iron Ranker, you're not really going to be doing a lot of Astral Magic. That makes a lot of sense.
So anyway, Jason spends pretty much the rest of the chapter unconscious. He uses the skill book, passes out.
Yep.
He wakes up, and then his system alerts him, you have no more stamina. And he passes right back out.
Yep.
And then he is awoken a third time. Dougal comes in, hits him in the face with the shovel twice. And he passes right the hell out, ending the chapter and bringing us to the end of this episode.
Yes, this is a fun group of chapters to do. The way that I had described what we've gone over so far is basically like a video game. Chapters 1 through 8 are like that stage of the video game. Right when you get out of the basic tutorial, like look up, look down, press A, you know, you are immediately thrown into, you know, what you can expect, kind of learn a little bit about how to interact with the world, what kind of challenges you'll face. Right. And then your first cooldown period where you're in between quests, you're going over all the cool stuff that you got, what everything right. does, just consuming everything you can consume, you know.
Introduction to the cool stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's pretty much the feel that I get out of this. You know, Jason fights a couple monsters, runs a little bit, and then goes over his loot and just starts consuming things that say he can consume them just to get some cool power.
Well, just to get some bearing in this new world, really. Like, that's his main concern is he's got no ground to stand on here. This is my situation. Let's go. I don't care. I need power. I need it now, and I need as much of it as I can get. See as being Jason's thing throughout. Give me power. Give me more. It's not enough. And coming up, we have got a big escape from the cannibals. We've got some new friends to meet, and we got a lot of fun stuff coming up in that next episode.
Yes, we do.
So for now... This is Team Biscuit signing off. I've been D. Allen.
I've been Donnie B. Join us next week.
All right, folks. We will see you next time.